This podcast is brought to you with limited interruption by Rudy Luther Toyota. Whether looking for an exciting brand new Toyota, a certified pre-owned vehicle, or getting quality routine maintenance and service for your vehicle, Rudy Luther Toyota is the place to go. Rudy Luther Toyota, the southeast corner of 394 and 169 in Golden Valley. Broadcasting live on the Civic Media Radio Network, it's the Matt McNeil Show for your Wednesday. Matt and Brett here today. I've got something in my hand. Oh, don't worry. Hey, apparently, are these Rick Smith's AirPods that he left in the studio?
I think from recording earlier today, they might be.
I think we've got a giveaway for tonight's movie night.
Won't Rick be surprised?
he's doing I'm sure he's over on Valley View Road right now, just spinning right, just jumping the median, coming back this way. Don't worry, I won't give them away, Rick. As a matter of fact, if we need to, I'll make sure I bring those. Let me know if I need to bring these into the movie night tonight. We of course up here in the we're based in the Twin Cities, and this is our first thing since the whole COVID thing, right? I mean, we've not done anything major like this in over 2 years, right?
The closest we did, we had one election or debate watching party in 2020, and that was it.
That was
outside of the Blue State Ball.
That was right. That was we did. Yeah, that's right. We had the guys from the Devil's Radio were up here, weren't they? Or was that? Yeah, was that? No,
we
that was,
did one in the general election debate, I believe, when Biden debated Trump. I think
that's right. That was before. That was during the Democratic primary.
That's pretty much been it between the 2020 Blue State Ball and now. So we haven't had many, so looking forward to actually getting out there again.
We appear at the flagship. We do a thing called the Blue State Ball. We did. We did one. We had one. Was it late February 2020 or was it early March?
Yeah, this was just a few weeks before
everything shut down, and it was the last thing we did. It was nice. We had a good turnout. I actually remember I had a friend of mine who called me up and said, Matt, I can't go. I'm sick as a dog. I don't know what I've got. And I'm like, oh, I must have the cold, a flu or something like that. Yeah, I think we figured that was. Needless to say, we haven't had anything major. We're going to have a good-sized crew over at Crooner's tonight. Crooner's Supper Club is, if you're in the Twin Cities metro area, it's on 65 Central Avenue, north of 694. It's just right there on the east side on Moore Lake. We got a humdinger of a lineup here. Not only is Rick Smith in town from the Rick Smith Show, which you hear weeknights here, 8 to 10 o'clock right here on AM 950, we've got the man himself in town, correct?
Yeah, why not? The star of the film, Greg Palast, is going to be there in person, and part of that panel discussion we'll be having about voting suppression right after the movie.
I believe Marge Hoffa from the DFL is going to stop on by as well, and so we'll look forward to chatting with her. So this is going to be fun, and I'm going to be out there for the evening. I'm heading on. I've got to do the show here. Apparently, there's something contractual here I got to fulfill. I got to do the show, and then after this, I got to go over and run home, hose down, and like washing an elephant at the zoo. And then I get a roll up there. I'll be at Crooner's as well this evening, through the evening. So I look forward to seeing you out there. And by the way, we do actually have some seating still available. It's free to get in, right?
Yeah, you just have to show up and
register at the door.
Register at the doors, yeah.
Whatever. Register at the door. So if you had not registered, but you're saying to yourself, I'd like to go see Rick Smith and Greg Palast, I would love to go there. And see this movie, you can get to Crooner's. The movie starts about, what, 6-ish, I believe it is?
Yeah, like 6:30, right around there.
6:30. So get there at 6, register at the door, we'll get you in. We have a few seats available. We look forward to seeing you tonight. We've got a pretty good-sized crew that's going to be there already. So looking forward to that. It's nice to get back and do things like this. And I got to tell you, Wisconsin folks, I'm more than happy to come swinging out in Wisconsin. I love to come out to some of the stations out there. It'd be a blast, absolute blast. So, I mean, if we're going to start doing this again, we're going to start doing this again. And I'm going to come on out there, and I don't mind. You will see the jackass you think I am. I am indeed that jackass. And it is as advertised.
And we kind of messed this up. We should have done this over the summer with all the festivals you were reading about.
What were we doing? I was not going to bring this up, but what the hell? Who dropped the ball on that one, man? I mean, I don't know what they've got in Oshkosh or Berlin or Amory, Stevens Point, Wisconsin Rapids, Wausau, Waukesha. Milwaukee's got a ton of great bone fans. We could go to Milwaukee every weekend. Madison's fantastic. Columbus. I could have been in any of these during the years. What do they have, like, you know, fish days or steak week or whatever they've got during the summer? I could have been out there in a heartbeat. You put me in the parade. I don't care. I'm there for the food, man. Small town food festivals. Someone dropped the ball on that. Someone dropped the ball. Anyway, I'll look forward to seeing you. I'm coming to see you soon. 952-946-6205. 952-946-6205. Well, we've got guests today. Stein joins us. Jeff Stein, our national and presidential expert. He'll join us here in about 20 minutes or so. Esther Agbaje is going to join us. This is Representative 59B, Democrat of the Day, coming up in the 4 o'clock hour for the Minneapolis-St. Paul folks. We got an election coming up here, and if you have not heard, oh my, crime is rampant, dun, 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 that's right. How many of you have heard from paranoid white people who never go into a metro area that crime is incredible? It's a no-go zone. It's a war zone. It's empty streets. Oh my God. It's worse than the worst. It's worse than something in Russia invaded. Oh my God. And we hear this a lot about the beautiful city of Milwaukee, the sensational city of Madison. My lovey-dovey is up here, Minneapolis and St. Paul. We hear this a lot about these cities, that the crime, it's just, it's horrible. You know, paranoid people that think going into a tertiary suburb strip mall to go get a chain restaurant dinner is hitting the deep, dark city, that sort of thing. They're basically bad-mouthing our towns, and I don't like it. But hey, maybe, we should take a look at the numbers here, because if you listen to a Republican talk about Milwaukee or Madison or Minneapolis or St. Paul, it's a war zone. It's a war zone. So it's good to have a roundup of the worst crime and best crime cities in America. Now, when I say best crime, it's not like, hey, you want to go commit a crime, the least amount of crime. You know, the cities that got the least safe and the safest. How about we say it like that? All right. And I'm sure I'll start at the top of the list. The safest cities. Oh boy. Like a warm cookie, huh? That would include such metroplexes as Columbia, Maryland, which nicely done for Columbia, huh? Maryland usually is not up on these lists. That's the number one safest city in the country. Nashua, New Hampshire. Ah, Pepperidge Farm remembers. Laredo, Texas, Portland, Maine, Warwick, Rhode Island. They're waiting for the harbor boats to come back in. Yonkers, New York, Gilbert, Arizona, Burlington, Vermont, Raleigh, North Carolina, and Lewiston, Maine. So overall, not a big surprise, I don't think, necessarily, across the board. A lot of them smaller towns. What's the biggest one in there? Is Laredo? Raleigh, North Carolina's got to be the number nine. That's got to be the biggest. But Portland, Maine, maybe is in there. But needless to say, you know, the safest cities here. Now, if we go with what Republicans say, I guarantee you, as we go to the bottom of the list. Now, that's 1 through 10 I just named off there. This list goes all the way down to number 100, and is it 182? I think is the last city here. So, I mean, clearly that's got to be either Minneapolis or Milwaukee, considering how Republicans talk about this. Number 182 is, St. Louis, Missouri. Which I've been to St. Louis. Yeah, I'm not going to argue there. So the one above that, it's got to be Milwaukee. The 181's got to be Milwaukee. Nope, that's Fort Lauderdale, Florida. And then it's San Bernardino, California, Detroit, Michigan, Baton Rouge, Louisiana, Memphis, Tennessee, Oklahoma City, Oklahoma, Oakland, California, Jackson, Mississippi, and Chattanooga, Tennessee. Chattanooga, I've been to Chattanooga. It was cute. Apparently, they've had come across some hard times. Huh. Wait a second here. Did I say Milwaukee or Minneapolis or St. Paul or Madison? No, I didn't. Well, okay. Matt. you're just toying with us because we know. We know the very next city on that list after Chattanooga, that's Milwaukee or Minneapolis. We know. Actually, it's Los Angeles, California, in 172. Richmond, Virginia, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, Cleveland, Ohio, Washington, D.C. Boy, as a matter of fact, as far as, you know, desolate hellscapes go, we're nowhere near the bottom of this list. The first city of the of Wisconsin, Minnesota that shows up here is Milwaukee. They're at 155, so not the best number. You're more on the bad side than the good side, but you're still better than places like Columbus, Ohio, Little Rock, Arkansas, Dallas, Texas, Washington, D.C. So, and you know, Vegas, and like I said, and a lot of conservative cities and conservative states where they said, I mentioned Oklahoma City, Oklahoma. Now, isn't that like Republican territory? We keep our crown down here. Apparently you don't. And so Milwaukee comes in at 155 on this list. I will, you know, it. So at 182, not the best, but it's still, it's not in the bottom 20. It's not in the bottom 25, I don't think. It's not in the bottom 25. So maybe you're just exaggerating Republicans because you have nothing else to run on. That's it. Let me do the other side of Wisconsin, Madison. Oh, you know how they rip on Madison sometimes? Oh, it's so horrible. It's number 13. Yeah, it's the 13th safest city in the country is Madison, Wisconsin, and it's delightful. It's delightful. Hey, by the way, Republicans that beat up on our towns, screw you. How about I say that from the bottom of my good old-fashioned heart? I'll tell you what we'll do. So Madison at 13, Milwaukee 155, but the worst is 182. Yeah, it's not good. But when I come back, obviously the Republicans must have tagged Minneapolis-St. Paul correctly. They must have, because it's a no-go zone. That's what they say. I say, don't come into my city, you jerks. I'll talk about that in a second. It's the Matt McNeil Show on the Civic Media Radio Network. Broadcasting live on Devil Radio, 92.7 FM in delightful Madison, Wisconsin, WTTN 1580 AM in Columbus, in Milwaukee and Waukesha, WAUK 540 AM, 101 FM, The Shaw, and on Bull Falls Radio, WXCO 98.9 FM, 1230 AM in Wausau. It's the Matt McNeil Show on your Wednesday. Once again, Stein here in just a little bit. So they did that thing where they split up the Twin Cities into two individual cities. How dare you? But, so you're saying to yourself, okay, 182 worst metro areas, Minneapolis, because that's what every Republican is screaming in the state of Minnesota right now. Hellscape, stay the hell out. Just don't come into town. We don't want you here. We don't. No, you're kind of a jackass. So stay away. But surprisingly, Minneapolis is not the highest or the lowest rated one on this. It's St. Paul, which comes in at 115. Out of 182, which means there's a good 60 or so cities well before St. Paul has a problem. And before you say to yourself, well, Minneapolis has got to be right there, right next to it. It's 114. No, it's not. It's not there. As a matter of fact, that's a tie between Phoenix, Arizona, and Fresno. If you're looking for Minneapolis, it's actually number 81. It's actually, there's 100 worse cities in Minneapolis, over 100 worse cities in the United States than Minneapolis. There's over 100. As much as every Republican in this state is screaming about, hellscape, no-go zones, I had to flee for my life, you're pathetic. You are pathetic. Because Minneapolis ranks better than the scarred hellscapes of places like Des Moines, Iowa, which is at 91. Rapid City, South Dakota, which actually I'm darn surprised that's not a little lower on the list if you want to know the truth. And metroplexes as Lubbock, Texas. Yes. So it's almost as if the entire argument that these Republicans are making is just kind of a made-up lie. And that They're just basically vilifying Milwaukee and Madison and Minneapolis and St. Paul for political reasons. And on behalf of everyone from Milwaukee and Madison and Minneapolis and St. Paul, who basically are the villains in your Republican narrative, don't come here. Oh, it's easy. Well, I like going to the Badger games. Well, no. You can't have it both ways. You can't vilify Madison and then all of a sudden show up and want to go to the game. I mean, it's a hellscape. You shouldn't want to go there. Or else you're full of it, a fraud. Which one is it? Oh, you're a fraud. Don't want to go to, say, a Brewers game or a Milwaukee Bucks game. If you want to go to Milwaukee, you go for those games, but, oh, it's bad everywhere else. Oh, just stay away. And I'll say the same thing for Minneapolis-St. Paul. This city kicks ass. Minneapolis-St. Paul is an amazing town. So all you bitter, angry, terrified of getting anywhere near the 494, 694 loop fools that basically like to vilify this town, don't come here. We're better off without you. No, seriously. We do a lot better off without you. Go. Go out feeling good in the neighborhood and act like you're living in the deep, dark city, okay? Seriously, the hell with all you people. And once again, I'm going to do this forever. And trust me, come the day after the election, I found any of these conservative friends of mine who have been basically bad-mouthed in Minneapolis, St. Paul, or Madison, or Milwaukee, and they basically come out and try to say, well, I was always there. Yeah, okay. I've got screenshots. And I'm going to throw them back in your faces. 952-946-6205. Speaking of which, who wants to warm themselves on the fire of joy? A Connecticut jury has found that conspiracy theorist Alex Jones must pay $965 million. That is a check. To several family members of those killed in the Sandy Hook school shooting for spreading lies that the shooting was fake. Jurors deliberated for 3 days in a trial that lasted 5 weeks. Multiple Sandy Hook family members, as well as an FBI agent who responded to the 2012 school shooting, sued Jones for his continued claims that the massacre of 20 children and 6 adults never happened. By the way, it did. Testimony in the Connecticut trial, which took place just 20 minutes from where the shooting happened, revealed the inner workings of Jones's media company and highlighted the cruelty family members faced from harassers. It was the second such trial in 3 months, with the Texas jury finding Jones must pay more than $45 million to a pair of Sandy Hook parents in August. He'll have to face trial in Texas again for his final Sandy Hook defamation case, and that date is to be determined. Wow, he's up to $1 billion, isn't he? Central to the trial were the comments Jones made on his conspiracy network, InfoWars, just days after the shooting. Parent Robbie Parker, whose 6-year-old daughter Emily was killed, gave a heartbreaking press conference a day after the shooting to talk about his child, but Jones focused on the nervous laugh Parker gave just before he started talking and used it to make the absurd claim that Parker was an actor and the shooting was staged. A torrent of harassment against Parker and other families soon began. It hasn't stopped since, said testimony showed, and a memorial page to his daughter. Parker found us up late at night, desperately trying to delete messages from extremists who claimed his daughter never died. That really threw me off, Parker testified. I was looking for something to keep me stable because my compass was spinning. I didn't know which way that was. And seeing these comments broke that connection. I had that stability. Nicole Hockley, whose 6-year-old son Dylan was killed, testified she sent pictures of dead children by harassers as she mourned the death of her own. I got sent pictures of dead kids because harassers said as a crisis actor, I didn't know what dead kids looked like, Hockley testified. These are just, I mean, all you people are just horrible human beings. You're all horrible, horrible human beings. And by the way, can I make a point here? Have you heard many Republicans condemning any of this? I haven't heard. I've heard some pretty full-throated condemnations from the Democratic side. But what I haven't heard is people on the right saying, you know, this is crossing a line. You can't do this. Parents of Mark and Jackie Barden, whose 6-year-old son Daniel was killed, testified they received a letter from someone claiming to have urinated on their son's grave. Another threatened to dig up the child's grave. As the families of those killed were forced to navigate the abuse, Jones and InfoWars saw profits go up, specifically on days when he called the shootings fake, evidence showed. For instance, on September 25th, 2014, InfoWars published a bogus story titled, FBI Says Nobody Killed at Sandy Hook Massacre. In a video about the bogus story, Jones told his followers that the FBI report showed no one died in 2012 in Sandy Hook, and it shows no homicides in that town. It was, of course, a lie, but that day, InfoWars store, which sells an amalgamation of supplements and survival gear, saw its revenue increase by nearly $200,000 from the day before, Eternal Records revealed. That's a 500% increase that attorney Chris Matei, who's representing the Sandy Hook families, told the court during the first week of the trial. InfoWars also saw spikes in traffic on days where Jones pushed his destructive lies. Yeah, just horrible human beings. Just a horrible human being. And, you know, one of the truth is I have zero doubt $965 million is going to put a pretty good-sized dent in that guy's bank account, but I don't know if it will actually completely bankrupt him. Hopefully the next trial is even more, and then we basically can ride this guy off the air and out of existence because, my God, what a horrible, horrible human being. We'll take a break, come back. Jeff Stein, when we do return, it's the Matt McNeil Show.
Baby, I don't need you.
Join Quorum as they celebrate their 29th annual National Coming Out Day luncheon presented by U.S. Bank. This inspirational and transformational luncheon gives voice to the power of living openly, honestly, and with authenticity at work, in our families, in our faith communities, and across our lives.
Jeff Stein is our national and presidential expert, noted author. You can find his books at your favorite book location. Of course, the Iowa Business Report, the Iowa Politics Report come to us from KXEL, Cedar Falls, Waterloo, Iowa. Hi, Jeff. How are you today? We have Jeff. Is he going to join us? Is he going to say something? Hi.
I think his mic is muted. Let me unmute him.
All right.
Hold on. Hey, Jeff, I think you need to unmute your mic.
You're on mute, Jeff. Hello.
There it is. There it is. I was just saying that today you're peddling soft drinks, it appears.
Well, I've worn this shirt only for like 12 years, so it's thanks for watching. I appreciate that.
Really? Only 12? I wouldn't have said any more than 10 and a half.
Scraping it off me tonight. Two things.
I'm not. I will not be.
No, don't. I've got a team for that. So two things I just learned, we learned here. And the first one is, did you know that former pitcher Randy Johnson is now a legit pro photographer and he's on the sidelines of NFL games shooting photos on the sidelines? That Randy Johnson, the pitcher, is now a professional photographer for the NFL.
I had no idea. Last I knew, he was pushing photographers on the streets of New York City when he signed with the Yankees. So that shows you how out of touch I am.
I just retweeted a photo of him. It is him. It's apparently legit. He was always an avid photographer, even when he played baseball. But now it's, you know, he gets done playing. He can do anything he wants. Why not? I can see why he would do that. Easy.
What, to get in free to the game?
You got to just watch out for Davante Adams, but he seems a little bit angry sometimes. But outside of that, you should be fine.
If you're 6'7" and 3 1/4.
Yeah, he's not going. Yeah, you're right. Randy Johnson is not the guy he's going to push down on that.
Right.
I did mention this before we went to break. The jury came on back on the Alex Jones trial, nearly $1 billion. A Connecticut jury found that he owes basically nearly $1 billion, $965 million for the families that he tormented with his lies. Just as you hear that, what's your thoughts on that?
Obviously, that jury wanted to send a message beyond the one that had already sent hundreds of millions of dollars. I mean, there's no way that the guy has that kind of money. And so what they are doing is being very, and I'm not saying it's a bad verdict. What I'm just simply saying is they are making it very clear that you do have a First Amendment right, but you also have a First Amendment responsibility. Again, the First Amendment only has to do with speech that a government could limit. We have always had rules for bad speech being punished. And that's what you're getting with this.
Well, in a larger sense, I mean, mm-hmm. I think Mike Lindell is going to be looking at a settlement somewhere in this range too. what you've got is, first of all, I think we need to understand Alex Jones makes a heck of a lot more money than I ever dreamed he did. In
oh,
the sense,
my goodness, yes.
They were talking about that on these days that he was going out there and attacking these Sandy Hook parents, he was making $200,000, $300,000 on his website on that day alone. So he's got a lot of money. And the reality is I think that a lot of these punishments up until this point, if you've got someone who is endlessly funded, who can basically make an appeal to their supporters and get checks written in the mail, get them to go to their website, go to buy the stuff, and generate tens of millions, if not hundreds of millions of dollars worth of revenue in a very short period of time, isn't it time actually now that these juries and these courts start looking at, okay, well, if this is the case, you know, and this punishment is not nearly enough to basically get you to stop and think about what you're doing, maybe we have to do send that message, whether that's, you know, Sandy Hook or January 6th or, a pillow guy basically attacking a company that basically makes voting machines. I think that you're looking at maybe this is the beginning of a new change where, fine, if the $10 million penalty is not enough to stop you from your outrageous behavior, then we'll make sure that we put something out that's going to be a little bit more sustainable.
You've got various different bits of law with all of this. With regard to Lindell, he's making comments about a company. Mm-hmm. That could tune to a whole category of trade libel, which is different than if he made statements against an individual. I'm not saying good or bad. I'm just simply saying now that's a whole different category because they can, in essence, quantify the loss in terms of people who wouldn't renew contracts with the machines, etc. When you're talking about private individuals, not public figures, not people who go on the radio and talk for a living, you know, talking about the parents of individuals, of children who have been killed. They are the definition of private citizen. They have no recourse other than through the courts. And that's why we have a distinction between public figures suing one another or somebody suing a public figure. You have to, if you're a public figure, you know, you have a harder time suing and winning for defamation because as a public figure, you have access to the media to a large degree. These parents don't have that. And remember in the first civil case, Matt, we knew how much Jones made because it was introduced into evidence. Mm-hmm. And so that jury said, we're going to slice off this percentage of it. Well, this new jury has said, we're not going to slice a percentage off of your net worth. We're going to multiply and make sure that you have nothing. Well, here's the other thing about it that's important. You have compensatory damages and punitive damages in legal actions. Compensatory damages are the ones to literally compensate for harm. The punitive damages are the ones where it is to prevent behavior from recurring. And in many states, the punitive damage award does not all go to the person suing. A great share of it often goes to the state's indigent defense fund or to some other fund. Because in other words, if the idea was to punish someone, compensatory damages compensated you for your loss. Punitive damages that are designed to send a message, you get a share of it, you don't get all of it. Mm-hmm. But again, these parents don't care about the money. Right. It has nothing to do with the money. It has to do with accountability.
Just one last quick question about this. First trial was in Texas. That was $45 million he owns. Now you got this one in Connecticut. And of course, it's going to be a lot bigger because it is Connecticut. It was 20 miles from where the shooting happened. That was $965 million, nearly over $1 billion now combined. Do you think this third trial is going to happen in Texas? Is that Connecticut trial sending a message saying, you know, $45 million is not going to be enough? That do you feel as if that trial goes the same route, he's found guilty again, that you're going to see a substantially larger finding for them in that case, do you think?
Not necessarily, and here's why. Because in theory, the juries are not going to know about the different cases. I say in theory because you don't want jurors who know nothing. You want them to have not formed an opinion. The other reason why I'm qualifying is the statutes in the state of Texas with regard to suing for damages may be different than in Connecticut. And so there may be different, there certainly would be different jury instructions, et cetera. So since the causes of action are rooted in different foundations, it's hard to say that a new jury in Texas is going to say, okay, I'm going to see your $1 billion and raise you another $1.5 billion. It's not exactly apples and oranges.
I don't think it would be $1 billion, but I could see them coming back and saying, okay, we're going to make it $150 million this time because of Texas. But you're right. I mean, Texas, I'm pretty sure, probably has laws that prevent massive findings against guilty parties in this case, because that's the way they are. They're already geared for the eventual lawsuits against the oil and gas industry. So let's just call
it a fair point. Yeah. And again, you're talking about a different cause of action. It's an excellent point, because when you're talking about an industry and harm through an accident or injury, that's a little different than libel slander. Mm-hmm. And these folks were claiming harm due to speech. And so, again, it's just very interesting from a legal standpoint. I'm sure Alex Jones doesn't find it too darn terribly interesting anymore. But it's interesting from a legal standpoint in terms of, you know, there are very specific lanes that you drive through on this.
Let's turn our attention to a different issue. We are less than 4 weeks away from the election.
27 days.
We are... I was looking at the number of voter registrations in the Kansas vote that they had earlier this year during that primary. Mm-hmm. He says most of the time when you see new voter registrations, you see nearly a 50-50 split, pretty close to it, you know, 49-51, something like that. But it is women, men. In that case in Kansas, 69% of new voters were women. We are starting to see more and more stories that are showing that women are indeed registering to vote in much larger numbers than men are, which is leading people to think, once again, as every Republican is screaming, abortion's not on the ballot, which, by the way, it is on the ballot. It's going to be on every ballot from here on out. You just might need to deal with that. The reality is I want to get your thoughts. How much do you think the abortion issue plays? I mean, I understand we can talk about inflation, we can talk about all these other things, but this seems to now, we've now crossed that line into a right being taken away, which is different than, you know, the bread and butter kitchen table issues you and I usually talk about. And it mm-hmm. seems to have changed the mentality of a lot of people. How much do you think are the Democrats going to go against the current in a midterm election this upcoming November?
Well, the first thing is, wasn't it the Republicans who for generations, 49 years, in fact, said abortion was on the ballot?
Yes. Every
and
time.
So now it's
every
not on
time.
The ballot anymore. Okay. And I'm not being flip, but I don't mean to make light of a very serious issue. But what I'm saying is, oh no, it's not on the ballot anymore. You used to think it was on the ballot until now, all of a sudden it isn't. Kansas, I'm going to put off to the side without taking full stock in it, because that special election or that primary election where they had that specific abortion item on the ballot. So you've got a very single issue. Literally, abortion was on the ballot there. It's not by name on the ballot elsewhere. And so I'm not saying that it has not energized women. What I am saying is that specific situation might be just narrow enough, specific enough to not allow a broad interpretation. Here's one other thing that, and I agree with you much more than I don't, but let me mention one more point where I'm going to kind of throw a little cold water on your argument. If, in fact, an election is about, quote, unquote, kitchen table issues, I think it is true that in most families, the female takes care of the money. And I'm not playing a stereotype. I'm not diminishing. I'm just simply saying in many of those situations, at least let's put it this way, when we have had other elections where it's very much a kitchen table issue election, women do turn out more because they're the ones trying to make the budget work. Now, if you've got a situation here where abortion is a huge issue, and I would suggest to you it is a huge issue in cities more than rural areas, that's going to change the dynamic. It's going to maybe not change statewide elections as much, but it is sure going to change in new congressional districts, new statehouse districts through reapportionment. And you're going to see, I think, some legislatures change hands or at least become much closer. Because as the population base increases in metro areas, they get more representatives. And if that's where abortion is a bigger issue, well, look what happens.
A few things. One, Kansas was a primary vote. The fact that so many people were registering to vote for a primary vote because that was primary day down there, and you had to be registered to vote in that election. I think that that kind of counterpoints a little bit of it. It's not, there's nothing there. I mean, they went and sought that out. Now, well, granted, there was an issue
that
on the ballot.
Had that initiative on it, though, yeah. Right? The Constitution.
But 538 is pointed to Nebraska 1, Minnesota 1, a lot of other races out there, which have shown when there isn't something on the ballot, there is a definitive 10-point swing that they have seen. Which, by the way, I was reading this analysis of the women registering at a much higher rate. The votes actually accounts for that 10-point swing. I mean, it actually is almost equals that these women registering to vote equals basically a 10-point advantage for the DFLers picking up. I'm not going to be like Michael Moore, who's looking at some, you know, city council race or library board race in Idaho as a bellwether. I think that that's too much fringe, and I think you get out there.
Yeah.
But I think you're seeing other things here that point to this being there. And also, I'll go back to what I said earlier, too. I'm not disagreeing with you on the idea that, you know, bread and butter issues, money issues are not important. But I think for women, or for men for that matter, for anyone, you know, is 10 cents more for a package of butter really going to say that's a much bigger issue than, oh, we can't get abortions and we'll be charged with a crime if we go to a different state? Now, we got to get to this break. And when we come back, I'll let you go and run with it from that point. Yep. Jeff Stein is kind enough to join us. 952-946-6205. It's the Matt McNeil Show right here on the Civic Media Radio Network. Broadcasting on locally grown radio, WFHR, 1320 AM, 97.95 FM in Wisconsin Rapids, Stevens Point. Lake Air, WXCE, 1260 in Amory. Air Support Radio, 98.3 in Oshkosh, 1100 AM, WISS in Berlin. And here on the flagship in Minneapolis, St. Paul, AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. It is the Matt McNeil Show for your Wednesday. Jeff Stein joining us. Jeff, go right ahead. I was making the points, counterpointing a little bit about Kansas. That it was there, but also this is showing up other places at 538 says so. And also, I mean, I think we're going to see this election cycle. Does, you know, inflation on items override a right being taken away?
By the way, what radio stations are you not on?
Well, I'm not on your station. When are you got? Well, yeah, I'd be a hit down there.
you have been on. I have had you on my station.
I have. That's right. I guess I've done your radio a few times actually.
Yeah, yeah.
No,
and they still keep me on. So, you know, how bad are you? The only thing I mentioned about Kansas is because that is the one thing that is different than those others. Now, the other races were very close in time to the Dobbs ruling. Let's go back to what we've talked about. Can you gin up that kind of motivation months after the ruling?
Well, now, consider, by the way, if I could say really quick with that, yeah, I keep hearing a lot. I mean, your point is valid, but it'd be one of those things where if it was starting to fade away, I'd say Republicans wouldn't be saying anything at all. But I still see a lot of Republicans and their talking heads screaming, "Abortion's not on the ballot." Which I mean, here we are; it's October. If this was really fading away, I think the last thing they'd be wanting to do is bring it up.
Well, and it all depends. Is it being asked directly? Are they responding to a question? I would agree with you that but here's the thing. You've got a very closely contested congressional race right here in my backyard. The Republican is in favor of the 15-week ban legislation. The Democrat is in favor of codifying Roe. They have made it. Both the Democrat and the Republican have made it a very big issue, because they are diametrically opposed on the topic. I have interviewed both. I think the only thing they agree on is that Congress should settle the issue, which is kind of interesting. Now, I had the Democrat in the studio Monday. We'll say it's Monday. And she wanted to really talk about early voting, and you can go to these centers that they've set up and how you get your absentee ballot. She never once said anything about Election Day. I had to at the end say, well, and of course you can show up on November 8th, right? Oh, well, sure. But we want people to see, this is where it's going to come down. It's all turnout.
Yeah.
Right. So if your side gets more of your people out early. You check the box showing they've already voted. Now you can work on independents. Now you can work on softer partisans. Hmm. And so this concept of really pushing to get people to vote early plays into exactly what you're talking about. Let's say you have people who are really solid on a certain issue and nothing's going to move them. Get those people in-house so you don't have to waste time trying to get them to show up on election day. You don't have to have it be one way or the other. It doesn't have to be, well, I'm voting because of abortion or I'm voting because of the economy. You could certainly have it be a trending sort of thing, right? Like, okay, it's tight here in the kitchen, but I also feel that I'm being pinched in some civil rights areas. It doesn't have to be one or the other. Mm-hmm. I keep seeing surveys, and I don't know why. I just keep seeing surveys that don't have abortion as high on the list. But that's a bad question, Matt, because they say, what's the most important issue for you? Mm. Well, again, we shouldn't be single issue voters. It should be a combination of things. Just because abortion ranks third or even fourth on the list of most important issues doesn't mean it isn't going to affect the outcome of this election cycle.
Well,
I was asked the other day how many seats, you know, and I said, I think the Republicans would maybe have a 10-seat advantage in the House, maybe. And I'm seeing all these folks saying, oh, it's a 35-seat advantage, you know, 150-seat advantage. I don't see it. I just don't feel it for the reasons you mentioned.
I'm not saying that the Republicans aren't going to win the House. I think that it's been interesting to watch the numbers slowly move to the Democratic side over the last few weeks.
That's what I'm saying.
Yeah, but it's not going to be nearly what they think it's going to be. I think I'll even niche down your point. It comes down to Democratic voter turnout. Because Republicans will turn out for the most part. I want to ask, or will they? Michael Moore's whole point is the other thing that's going to play against Republicans in this election is that there are a lot of Republican voters who are furious about January 6th that are not being vocal. It's not being vocalized. It's not being talked about. But that he feels is, and he points to that Idaho case, which once again, I think that's more of a regional issue. But he says that this is it. Are you seeing Republican voters who are saying, you know what, I've voted Republican a long time, but you don't try to overthrow an election in a government just because your guy lost?
No, I don't see it at all.
You don't see it at all?
I don't see that at all. Here's what I see. I see Republican complacency. And they, you know, because they've been told by the echo chamber they listen to, red wave, red tsunami. What other phrases can we use to describe how it'll be red all over? I think they're going to have a harder time with turnout. And again, it's state by state, but I happen to be in a state where the top races on the ticket are not competitive. Congressional, yes, but not necessarily the statewide races. Do people decide to stay home? I mean, I just don't think it's going to be a red wave. I don't feel the January 6th thing you mentioned. I respect the opinion. I don't see it. Mm-hmm. I just see this sense of Kevin McCarthy's already measuring for drapes in the speaker's office kind of thing. And frankly, I don't think a lot of Republicans like Kevin McCarthy. And that's one of the things. It's not going to drive down necessarily voting for Trump-endorsed candidates for Congress. But there is the best thing that the Democrats can hope for is that the Republicans get a working majority with Kevin McCarthy as speaker. He will go down in flames before the cherry blossoms bloom, and it sets the table for 2024.
And I think the problem that he has is that it's if he does only have 2 or 3 seat majority, then he needs everyone on board. If they're going to try to impeach Biden or they're going to try to, you know, codify or make abortion illegal nationwide, these are not going to be votes that play well for them, especially coming 2024.
Right.
I agree with you. I don't know if Republicans, still think at the end of the day, I look at Georgia, they're all going to show up and vote for Herschel Walker. They will. They will vote. I mean, it's as much of a disgrace as that candidate is, they will, because they just don't know how to not vote in an election. They're that good at it. I think that does the abortion issue finally do what the Democrats have been promising, which is big voter turnout?
I think, you know, since you mentioned Georgia, I think Governor Kemp wins, but I think Senator Warnock wins.
I do. Agreed wholeheartedly. I think Kemp is going to win that.
Yeah, I think so. But I also think Warnock. I mean, so it's not, voters are smarter than the political hacks give them credit for. Yep. There's your quote of the day.
There you go. Jeff Stein, once again, find his books at your favorite book location. The Iowa Politics Report we'll put up later. Jeff, thank you very much. We'll talk to you in 2 weeks. Coming up, Devil Radio for the Wisconsin folks, Minneapolis, St. Paul. Hour two is up next. AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. It's the Matt McNeil Show on your Wednesday. Good to have you with us, Matt and Brett here today. Brett, what the heck was that falling out of the sky for a good chunk of the afternoon today?
Uh-oh, was it what I think it might be? That's not something we want in October?
No, it wasn't snow. It was rain, just anything.
Oh, okay.
I'll take anything at this point, any precipitation, because it's really dry out there. As a matter of fact, there was a wildfire warning issued for the southern part of Minnesota because it's been so dry. So we got some rain. Yay.
Yeah, we're not getting much. I mean, I'd rather not have it in the sleet form, which it appears we're going to get over the next few days, but it's better than nothing, I guess.
We're getting sleet? What?
Yeah, tomorrow night.
It's not going to freeze. It's just going to sleet, right?
Yeah. Nothing accumulating, obviously, but it's going to be a mix of rain and snow tomorrow night. So enjoy.
It's that time of year. It is that time of year. And not only is it the time for weather to take a turn and get to Halloween, all that good stuff here, but it is of course also election season. Joining us right now is our Democrat of the day. We head to Minneapolis itself, 59B. Representative Esther Agbaje is kind enough to join us. She is representing 59B, which is the downtown area and the north side. She's kind enough today to talk about her reelection campaign. Representative, thank you very much. I appreciate the time.
Thank you so much. It's great to be with you.
Congratulations. You, of course, won in 2020, and you've gotten 2 years in a fairly competent House with the Democrats in charge, dealing with a fairly incompetent Senate run by the Republicans. Your thoughts just on your first 2 years there in St. Paul?
I always tell people it is a fascinating and terrifying place all at the same time. but no, I think the House did a really good job of pushing forward a number of bills and investments into our communities, especially those having to deal with our young people and having to deal with housing and health issues, education. All of those things I think were great to be behind, as well as some civil rights issues. And we were able to pass a couple of bills, even with our Senate colleagues. And so that's why you've been able to see some, you know, COVID investments that we had last year, as well as this year moving into more mental health resources, as well as doing some work for our foster care system. So, yeah, it's been some ups and downs in these past couple of years.
You are a big advocate for housing. Let me ask, first of all, 59B, did it change much with the redistricting?
It changed a little. So we, you know, lost, some of our neighborhoods that were further south into downtown, neighborhoods like Bryn Mawr and Elliott Park, they were redistricted out. But we did bring in areas of St. Anthony, Maine, which is kind of where the Stone Arch Bridge is. And then we also got a little bit more of our neighbors on the north side. So I think the shape of the district is still relatively the same, but we have a lot of density in the area. So we definitely have, you know, good numbers of people in all of the apartment and condo buildings and that we have across the district.
I want to get to housing then. And that's why I wanted to talk about the district, because you're in a fairly condensed area, a high density area. We need housing. I mean, we need housing in every community, including in the most rural of rural, you know, cities in the state. It is something that is not really being addressed. And it seems like the only two things that get built nowadays are massive apartment complexes, which pretty much are priced out of a lot of people's, you know, pocketbook anyway, or McMansions, these huge houses. Those are the only two options. Talk about the fight to get affordable housing built, not only in your district, but across the city and across the state.
I think you hit you hit it right on the head. Affordable housing is a crucial need across the state. And here in my district in particular, we see that with a lot of the apartment buildings going up, the luxury condos going up, just as you said, people are getting priced out. And we need to make sure that we are actually focusing on spending money on rehabilitating some of our older housing stock to make sure that, those are habitable places for people to live, and hopefully that they're also at a lower price point and that they're meeting people's budget needs, because we want to make sure that our families have safe places to stay. Because the thing about affordable housing, it's really not, it's more than just a commodity. It's more than just a return on investment if you're a small-time landlord, but it really is a place where people can go and call home. It's a place where they have rest, refuge, where they can take care of themselves. When kids know that they're not going from place to place, they can do better in school. Parents also do better at their jobs when they know where they're going to be every day. And so that's why it's really important that we focus on housing. And in other parts of the state, we know that there are lots of areas that new businesses are coming there. They need workers to live close by, and we need to make sure that we have affordable housing in other parts of the state, so that way people don't feel like they can't get those jobs because there's nowhere to live around there. So those are some of the things that we're facing kind of as a statewide issue. I would say, particularly in my district, I do focus a lot on landlord-tenant issues because we have a significant portion of renters, if not maybe even majority renters in my district. And we want to make sure that renters are living in safe and stable places, that their landlords are being held accountable if they're not keeping up with repairs like they should. Mm-hmm. And then also working closely with our city and county counterparts to make sure that there's kind of a level playing field for people, that if they have, you know, reports of complaints or something like that, that there's someone there on the other side to answer it.
This has always been a fight when we talk about landlords and renters, is that you always for there's a lot of great landlords. There's a lot of great owners of apartment buildings. They do a wonderful job, and it's very nice. It's appreciated for sure. But you always do end up having, you know, some of these landlords who do not have their renters' best interests in heart, and in some cases start to get to the point of jeopardizing the people that are in their building. You know, talk about that a little bit more, because it's clear that we're always going to have some level of this. How do you make sure that you get the accountability without basically putting harnesses on all of them, especially the ones that are not doing the bad job, that are doing the good job?
You know, I think it all goes down to communication. The landlords who are doing a good job, they don't have to worry about, you know, what is coming in to make sure that their tenants also have access to the same judicial system that they do. Because if you have that communication in place, you probably can work out a lot of these issues without ever having to go to court. But a lot of the bills that we've put up this year and in previous years before I was even in the legislature is really about ensuring that renters especially can access the same judicial system, can access the court system, can make sure that their voices are heard when something goes wrong. And then for those landlords who aren't doing what they're supposed to do, to know that, you know, there are enforcers around who will make sure that you are actually providing a safe place to live for people. So some of the bills that we've put forward and have put forward multiple times are things about making sure that there's adequate notice before an eviction happens, because sometimes if you have adequate notice, and about the average across country is usually 14 days. Even the city of Minneapolis now actually has a 14-day pre-eviction notice, which is great. That gives the renter time to find resources, because it's usually going to be a non-payment of rent issue, and it helps them find emergency assistance resources. It helps them find maybe an attorney if they need one. And then so that way, maybe you can resolve those issues before you even get to the court. Another thing that we've continued to push multiple times is having evictions be expunged from people's records, because what happens now in the state of Minnesota is once that landlord files, there's been no court case, there's been no appearance before a judge, but it's just been filed, just an allegation, that follows that person, that renter's record for a very long time, which then makes it much more difficult for them to secure housing in the future. So we want to make sure that if you go to your court case and it gets dismissed, or you win, or you get a settlement, that falls off immediately. And then finally, one of the things that really helped a lot, especially during the height of the pandemic, is making sure that if you are in line for assistance, and that's emergency assistance, maybe you're getting funding from a nonprofit, or, you know, the city or the state or the county has funds available to help renters stabilize and be in their homes, that you can't be evicted while you're waiting for that money to come in. And we saw that worked really well for about 18 months during the height of the pandemic, and we want to make sure that we're bringing something like that back, because it's about making sure people can stay home, but also making sure that our landlords are getting paid, especially those who are doing a good job.
Representative Esther Agbaje is joining us. 59B is the district. Let's go back to housing a little bit here, because there is, it's kind of the ugly truth of it. When you, and I was on a planning, and I was on my city's planning and zoning committee for a while. And one of the things that we always addressed was wanting to try to make sure we had affordable housing being built, you know, not just, you know, upper class housing, or, you know, housing that was pricing out a lot of people, a lot of the renters. When you say I'm going to build low income housing on this block, on this site, the next thing you generally hear is a lot of the people that live around that site saying, wait a second here, what do you mean low income housing? Why aren't you building, you know, other housing here that can actually increase the area's value? Why are we doing this? Talk a little bit about that, because there, to a point, and this has been something that's been talked about a lot, part of the problem for the city with affordable housing is that it's, you know, it's kind of fine if it's over on the other side of town, but if it's in your neighborhood, there's a tendency of people in the city to not be supportive of it.
No, I think you bring up a great question that comes up all the time when we start talking about public housing, low-income housing. I think those monikers too, we have to remember that everyone deserves a safe, clean, dignified place to live. Whether, you know, that's an efficiency or a one bedroom or a single family house if a person so desires. I think when we talk about this, we should really be thinking about how are we caring for our neighbors and how are we caring for those around us and providing those amenities. And those amenities in the long term will provide value to a community. I think, you know, what I find a lot, particularly in my district and throughout the city of Minneapolis, is there are a lot of people who do want to become homeowners. They see that as a path towards wealth, and I think that is a path to get towards wealth building. And I think we need to be looking at how can we build homes that people can actually afford to buy. And whether that is a single family home or duplex or some other type of shared housing situation, I think we need to look more at those. When we're also looking at apartment complexes, I think mixed income housing is really good, because part of that is really making sure that we're getting people at all levels that are mixing and interacting with each other, can start to build that social networking with each other as they get to know their neighbors. What we don't want to do is we don't want to concentrate areas of poverty, because we know over history, watching how things have happened throughout the country, that just tends to exacerbate some of the issues that we see and some of the problems that can come with it. But if we start mixing things around, we start, you know, having, you know, more high income people live with lower income people, maybe that builds new opportunities. If we have mixed use type of housing as well, where maybe you have some businesses on the bottom floor, on the first floor, ground floor, and then you have units up above. There's so many things that we can do, especially in our district where we do have a lot of density. People do want more walkable neighborhoods. They do want more amenities. And I think there's ways that we can get creative in making sure that we can create healthy, habitable, dignified housing for people who want it.
Well, and then this goes hand in hand with another issue you talk about, and that's public transit. I know that we are in this new age. We're trying to figure out how much of the workforce is going back into the downtowns, going back in. I mean, a lot of people are now, at least on a part-time basis, working from home every week. So there is a change that's going on. We're still trying to figure this out. But the reality is we still have businesses downtown that need workers. And reality is downtown is not affordable for most workers. They're having to come on in. We need to have reliable public transit that can get the working class in, because I still even also agree, even if you do have a car, it's not cost effective to be able to park it anywhere downtown. So we have to have this option on the table. Talk a little bit about that, because I know that this is something where I think Republicans feel as if with the change that's happened after the pandemic, that public transit is something that can be more on the chopping block for them than it has been in the past.
Yeah, public transit is crucial. I mean, you know, as someone who has lived in downtown for a number of years, that is my main way of getting around, if not walking. So it's true, because I've talked to so many people who, you're right, they work downtown, but they live in the suburbs, and it's hard to get here sometimes from even just our first ring suburbs. So I would really much want to see greater investment in bus rapid transit, making sure that, you know, we have dedicated bus lanes so that way the bus can actually move faster and move on time. Because what we find is that when people see that there's high frequency for public transportation, it's highly dependable, they tend to use it more often because, like you said, no one really wants to drive a car around and then figure out a parking space and pay money for that. Like, it's a lot of a hassle. But if you can just jump on a bus or jump on a train and get to where you need to go and maybe walk a couple blocks, I think so many people would much prefer that. So I'm hoping that, you know, when we go back in the session in January, that we will look really closely, especially with a lot of the federal funding coming for infrastructure, that we're looking closely at how we're building out our public transportation lines in the metro area for sure, but also even in some of our other city centers around the state. I've talked to friends of mine who live in central Minnesota, and they would really appreciate having a reliable and dependable bus system up there to help them get around, help them get their kids from different play dates or to recreation centers, like all of that. It's very useful.
I still, for the life of me, do not know why we don't expand metro mobility into outstate and offer it for especially the seniors who live on their farm home. They need to go into town to go grocery shopping or go to church or something like this. Having an option to where you could have a flexible, you know, transportation system that can get people around, I think it would make life, especially in outstate Minnesota, a much better promise. But once again, when you start talking about public transportation like this, if you say it, public transportation, a lot of Republicans shut down. But if you say, hey, we want to make sure that the people who live out in these farm areas where there still is some houses available, they can still get into town without, without necessarily having to drive every time themselves. And I think that's something that has to be addressed, hopefully, in the next few sessions here over in St. Paul.
I hope so, too. Well, we'll be working on it. I know we'll.
One last quick thing, if I can ask, Representative. I wanted to talk a little bit about public schools and making sure that there's the achievement gap is closed. A study came on out that said that basically Minnesota schools are 20% behind on budget because so many years because of conflict, the budgets don't get any increase. It's set at the same rate. Henceforth, inflation's not factored in. Henceforth, we're actually putting less money in per student than we were, 20% less. That's part of the problem, as well as also, I think, and this is a good thing, I think we're finally dealing with this Archie Comics idea of education where it's, very European white centric, and it just can't be that way and expect to have, the results that we want to get. So talk a little bit about that. How, in your mind, is the best way we can address the achievement gap?
I think we really have to look at each of our kids in public schools as our kids. That's where it starts. And so every kid deserves a stellar world-class education. And we can provide that in Minnesota through our public education system. And we have the funding to do it. We have the resources to do it. But you're right. We just haven't quite pegged those numbers yet to inflation. We also are still leaving some of our school districts behind. I know the Minneapolis School District talks a lot about fully funding our special education and fully funding our English language learner programs. And those are necessities that people need in order to make sure that our kids are doing well in school. And so I really think that if we can kind of switch our mindset a little bit, that education is a right and education is something that everyone deserves and that we need to make sure that our kids have the tools to go out and be successful in the world, wherever it is they want to go. I think if we look at our public education system that way, I hope that will help bridge some of the hurdles about how much it costs. But in order to have a world-class education system, you do have to put in the money to it, and you have to make sure the money is going to the right places, is being spent appropriately, and is going to help the schools that have been left behind and really need those resources.
59B is the district. The representative is Esther Agbaje, is kind enough to join us here. Representative, if people would like to find out more about your campaign and your issues and where you stand on everything, help you out perchance on your election here, what's the website they should go to?
They should go to www.estheragbaje.com. I'll spell it out, ESTHERAGBAJE. Otherwise, you can find me on social media. All my handles are at @Go4Esther.
All right. I'll link to everything on social media a little bit later on, too, so you can find it via the station social media pages as well. Representative Esther Agbaje. Representative, thank you very much. I appreciate the time. A great conversation today. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much. Really appreciate it. You guys have a good rest of the day.
You do. Democrat of the day for today. Let's take a break. Come on back. It's the Matt McNeil Show right here on AM 950. AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. It's the Matt McNeil Show. I'm excited about the movie night tonight. I'm looking forward to seeing everyone out there. Crooners, go up there and join us. By the way, what do I do? Has Rick called? Rick Smith, the Rick Smith Show.
Oh, we did actually hear. Yes, that was his producer that left his headphones in. So
this is producer?
Yeah.
Oh, the producer. I can lick these in, right? I mean, the producer, right?
Yeah.
I'm not trying to impress the producer.
Why are these soaking wet?
Delicious. Speaking of delicious, was one of us supposed to bring this over to the
Yeah, if thing? You can bring it over, we'll help them out.
Let's put it in my warm pocket. Speaking of delicious, so apparently a Fox Business contributor has said he went to lunch today. Where did he go to lunch? Taco Bell. How much did he say his lunch cost him? $28 at Taco Bell for his lunch.
What state was he?
I have gone to Taco Bell's official website. This is nationwide. And pulled up the menu costs. Did he eat? He had at $28, he had enough for 4 double steak grilled cheese burritos. Oh God. You do not want to be in the house with this man at this point. 4 of those? Holy God. Let's go to specialties. Let's see what it gets for specialties. Well, okay, what's the most expensive specialty here? We got a chalupa's only $3. So, I mean, how many chalupas is that? 6? No, it's 8. Eight chalupas. Jeez, what are you doing, man? You know, usually you leave a note. The Mexican pizza, which it's not bad. $4.49, so that's 5. 5 of, God, what are you doing? This is a cry for help. The Doritos Cheesy Gordita Crunch Nacho Cheese Flavor. Well, that nacho cheese flavor is going to be sticking with you for a while because that's 5.5 of those, $28. Oh, what are you doing with your body? Your just intestinal system's like, no, stop.
I was curious if he lives in one of those states that's legalized marijuana where maybe he just
is there anything more expensive? The burritos, the heavy-duty burritos with the extra steak and cheese and that's 4 of those. Is there anything else on this that comes close? I'm looking at we can go to the Cravings Value menu. Let's see what this guy is going to be doing to his internal system with these. Oh, here we go. The Beefy Melt Burrito. $2. That means this man ate 14 of them. Oh, dear, what are you, a frat boy on a bet? My God. I want you to know how bad inflation is. Yesterday, yes, I had a nice lunch at Taco Bell. It cost me $28 at Taco Bell for lunch. As the one person, Eric Kleefeld, wrote, how is this even physically possible? Oh, God. Oh, dear Lord. The Chipotle Ranch Grilled Chicken Burrito. Oh, eating light. That'd still be 14 of those. 14. Let's go to the breakfast. Should we go to the breakfast items? Let's see what the breakfast items do for us here. This is. Don't they have the round thing? It's the quesadilla sausage. Oh, God. Oh, here it is. This has got to be up there. The breakfast Crunchwrapped sausage. Well, it's only $3.19. That he can have 8 of those. Well, okay, so if he does the breakfast crunch wrap combo, if this was his lunch, the breakfast crunch wrap combo, which basically comes with a side of despair and hatred, it's $5.79. Actually, no, it comes with coffee and some sort of thing that's got something in it. I'm not sure. It's a side dish. It's if $5.79, he can get 5.5 of those. Okay, so this is, and I want to also put this out. Why don't we, if we're going to do the breakfast crunch wrap combo, 5 of those, that's 5,000 calories. 5,000 calories. Okay, I got to go back to the burrito. That's the most expensive thing I could find on this menu was the burritos. So going back to the the double steak grilled cheese burrito, which runs for $6.79, which means that basically he can get four of these. They're 920 calories each. So he's basically getting a day and a half's worth of caloric intake in one four burrito sitting at Taco Bell. I'm going to make a good argument. He's probably not eating anything else in that day and a half. I'll default to Parks and Rec when they had their episode about everyone having stomach bug. And he said, I broke the porcelain in the bottom of the toilet. I'm going to guess. Bon voyage. Enjoy. $28 at Taco Bell. For one human being who is apparently, is he alive? I don't know. I've never seen this guy before. I mean, the one guy says this and like everyone else starts laughing. Cavuto is like laughing at this whole thing. Oh my God. Someone who eats $28 of Taco Bell for lunch is someone who should not be trusted ever about anything. You absolutely did not eat $28 of Taco Bell and on your own without it involving another $200 in alcohol and drugs. Oh, this guy's going to get every bit of grief he can because he lied. I mean, listen to it. He lied to try to, it's so bad, I had to pay $28 for Taco Bell. Yeah, man, you just owned. You're a $28 Taco Bell guy.
How many cans of air freshener do you think it would take to get rid of that mess?
Man, you'd have to like fill your room with potpourri and just kind of wade through it like it's like a heavy snowstorm. 952-946-6205. 952-946-6205. Hey, I've got some more. This is going to seem like a shock. Do you know the Crock-Pot, Kim Crockett? Crock-Pot apparently has an interesting job history. We'll talk about that when we do return. It's the Matt McNeil Show right here on AM 950. Ugh. People are trying to defend the $28 at Taco Bell by saying, well, this is what you pay. Well, you're paying for a delivery service. This guy said he went to Taco Bell. You know, if you've got a delivery service, and I know delivery in like Los Angeles, New York is pricey. So, I mean, if it's $28, if 12 of it is your delivery cost, you know, you're still having a pretty damn big meal.
You're making a mistake if you're ordering Taco Bell delivery.
I saw them saying that was a Holiday gas station says they've got DoorDash.
Who is doing that?
I don't know.
I want my gas station hot dog. Can you please deliver it?
How many gas station hot dogs would $28 get you? I'm going to guess 12. At least 12.
I was thinking that could be on the low side.
Oh, God. Jesus. What are you doing, man? $28 on Taco Bell will buy you one thing, a body bag. Got the responses to this are one of the funniest things I've ever seen. $28 of Taco Bell, or otherwise known as your stomach has a spin cycle. Oh, God, this is just, the guy claims he had $28 of Taco Bell for lunch by himself. And we just went and looked at their menu. That's a lot of food, man. What's this guy? The Taco Bell challenge has now entered the fray, which is basically so here's what this guy has done. He's gone to the Taco Bell menu to get $28 worth of food. He gets first the chicken quesadilla combo with a Mountain Dew Baja Blast. I don't think that's helping. He's getting creamy jalapeno sauce, three cheese blend, and extra steak added, plus a soft taco supreme. That's $13.19. Then comes the Cinnabon pack, a delights of $6.79. Well, that's still $20. Is this a delivery? This looks like a delivery too. Yeah. Jeez, you have to add delivery cost to eat. But even with the delivery cost, you still have to have an obscene amount of food to get anywhere close to it. Jeez. Guy deserves every bit of grief he's about to get, and he's going to get it from, well, both sides.
That he will, yes.
Uh-oh. 952-946-6205. 952-946-6205 is the phone number. Hey, let's go talk about the crockpot, shall we? Kim Crockett. This is the Republican candidate for the Secretary of State position. In case you missed it, she actually aired an anti-Semitic video at the GOP convention back in May, and they applauded. And she's got a lot of things. But let's take a look-see here at a little bit of something else here. For nearly two decades, Bloomington has... This is a story from the Minnesota Reformer, by the way. For nearly two decades, Bloomington has traced the political path of the inner ring suburbs to the Twin Cities. The residents become more diverse and progressive, sending a stream of Democrats to the state legislature. So residents in Bloomington might be surprised to learn that their city is also home to a highly influential right-wing think tank that reaches millions of people every single day. I mean, that doesn't surprise me because you do write it there on 494. I mean, it's not exactly like you're, you know, it's exclusive, you know, on the 494 strip. In 2018, the right-wing nonprofit blog Intellectual Takeout changed names to become the Charlemagne Institute and merged with a conservative think tank, the Rockford Institute, longtime publisher of Chronicles, a magazine for American culture. Back in 1989, the conservative Christian cleric, the Reverend Richard John Newhouse, who worked for Rockford at the time, called Chronicles nativistic and insensitive to the classic language of anti-Semitism. Although the Institute has largely known outside of right-wing political intellectual circles, Charlemagne's one-time vice president, Kim Crockett, is in the spotlight since winning the GOP nomination for the Minnesota Secretary of State. So Kim Crockett was one time the vice president of this organization. Crockett was hired at Charlemagne, and boy, nothing speaks to you like cutting-edge institute than taking the name of a 1,500-year-old dead guy. I tell you what, nothing says progress like that. Crockett was hired at Charlemagne soon after John Elliott was fired there in 1929. He was dismissed after a tranche of racist emails were revealed in which Adolf Hitler was such a common topic of adulation that Elliott and his colleagues had coded phrase for Hitler of our good friend. Wow. Now he did leave. That was the line that was drawn. But Elliott was hardly an outlier at Charlemagne. However, Charlemagne Institute staff have been accused of racism and anti-Semitism multiple times in recent years. A regular columnist for the Charlemagne Institute's magazine Chronicles has publicly affiliated with the criminal neo-fascist organization Golden Dawn. The magazine's editor-in-chief was a mentor to white supremacist activist Richard Spencer and once claimed to have helped Spencer coin the term alt-right. Nor was Crockett out of place at Charlemagne. Before and since, she's shown an affinity for white supremacist ideas and anti-Semitic tropes. A Crockett campaign video at the Republican State Convention in May used an anti-Semitic canard to criticize arch-liberal billionaire George Soros, DFL Secretary of State Steve Simon, and Democratic Party election lawyer Mark Elias, all three which, of course, are Jewish. After the Republican Party apologized on her behalf, she sent out a fundraising letter that referred to contrived and bogus political attacks and showed an image of her apparently lounging lakeside with sandaled feet and a Tucker Carlson book. Neither Crockett nor Charlemagne responded to interview requests for this story. Funny story. Although Charlemagne and its one-time vice president are enjoying a moment of prominence, their strand of rhetoric has was once extinguished, consigned to the fever swamp, as Newhouse said. Newhouse, Father Newhouse, after converting to Roman Catholicism, was a leading figure in the development of the relatively globalist, pluralist, and secular brand of conservatism. After severing ties with Newhouse, Rockford established itself as the custodian of a more nativist and anti-democratic conservative tradition. Though arriving at the scene later, the Charlemagne Institute and Crockett are heirs to that tradition. In the reporting of the 1989 split between Rockford Institute and Newhouse, the New Yorker Times characterized the incident as a dramatic expression of the deep divisions between two major strains of conservatism. One of Rockford's funders quoted the article, contrasted Newhouse's forward-looking free market conservatism with the conservatism of the larger organization. Rockford, particularly in its magazine, Chronicles, is somewhat critical of free markets and spreading democracy. It looks back to an agrarian society. Wow. Small towns, religious values, it seems modern times is too secular, too democratic. Agrarian society, in that quote, is a reference to Chronicles' romanticism of the antebellum South. The editor of the time was Thomas Fleming, who closely linked the neo-Confederate movement, which minimizes the horrors of slavery, its central role in Confederate secession and the festering influence of the modern-day American life. Before taking control of Chronicles, Fleming founded another magazine, Southern Partisan. Wow. In a 2000 essay, the historian Edward Sebesta called the two magazines the major publications of the Neo-Confederacy and notes that at the time, every editor for Chronicles was a member of the Neo-Confederate organization, the League of the South. Here's what Fleming wrote in Chronicles in 1996 in an essay called The Illusions of Democracy. Whatever trust we are to put in race and IQ correlations, the black achievements both in Africa and North America give little indication that black people, taken statistically in mass, poses the kinds of abilities that are required to success in the modern world. Wow, they're not even trying to hide it there, are they? Through the 1990s and 2000s, Chronicles maintained a position of influence among prominent conservatives such as Pat Buchanan, Texas U.S. Senator John Cornyn, who spoke at Rockford Institute's conference moderated by Fleming in 2006. This despite the magazine's ongoing displays of extremism. Defending Mel Gibson in 2006, the Chronicle's essay, after some of the actor's anti-Semitic comics became public, Fleming wrote, "Theories of history are a matter of fact and reason. The fact that so many troublemakers from the past 150 years have been Jewish, Marx, Freud, the neoconservatives, it's clearly no argument in their favor. Jewish intellectuals continue to be the forefront of the movement that aimed to destroy religion and culture." Wow. In 2008, the magazine inaugurated a regular column founder of Tacky's Magazine. At the time, Tacky's Magazine was edited by white supremacist activist Richard Spencer. It later served as the launching pad of the Proud Boys. In 2006, Chronicles essay, Serbian ultranationalist called the well-documented massacre of 8,000 Muslim men and boys in the Bosnian Serb army a myth to feed what would be suicide bombers. In 2011, he was refused entry into Canada for this and other acts of genocide denial. The next year, Chronicles made him its foreign affairs editor. Fleming retired in 2015. Chronicles write-up in the announcement reads, in part, Dr. Fleming is an intellectual giant, an American conservative's unsung hero. Rockford Institute board chairman Raymond Welder, the proof of his consistently excellent work, 30 years of writing in monthly magazine, blah, 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 blah. In 2009, a handful of staff and board members from the Golden Valley-based conservative think tank Center for the American Experience founded a blog called Intellectual Takeout. 9 years later, Intellectual Takeout was renamed the Charlemagne Institute and merged with the Rockford Institute. Since the merger, Charlemagne has emphasized continuity with the Fleming years. Its website features glowing testimonials from Pat Buchanan, Ronald Reagan, and Tom Wolfe. They also kept the racial politics. In a recent article on their website, Buchanan took aim at the defining dogma of liberal ideology, egalitarianism, the notion that all people are created equal. Buchanan describes a handful of racial disparities that concludes by saying, what if an inequity of rewards of society is predominantly a result of inequality of talents and abilities? Yeah, and he leaves the answer and its racial implications unspoken. Multiple writers have traced the line from Buchanan's 1990s presidential campaigns to the Trump-era alt-right. Several have drawn the straight line through Chronicles. Buchanan used to dine once a month with regular Chronicles contributors. Writing for The Week, Michael Doherty said the Chronicles piece Francis wrote about, Buchanan reads like a political manifesto from which Trump campaign springs. The magazine's connection to the alt-right is not merely historical trivia. The Jewish online magazine Tablet called current Chronicles editor Gottfried the Jewish godfather of the alt-right and described him as a mentor of Richard Spencer. The term alt-right first appeared in the print in Taki's magazine in the Spencer-penned headline of the Gottfried article. Gottfried is quoted in the Tablet article disavowing white nationalists in general and Spencer in particular. Whenever I look at Richard, I see my ideas coming back in a garbled form. However, Gottfried characterized his split from Spencer as being driven by strategic differences. Far from being a fever swamp of isolated racism, Chronicles is one of the foci around which the far-right political movement draws itself. Given its prominent decades-long role in American right, it might seem odd to obscure Minnesota blog would be handed the reins like Chronicles. However, Intellectual Takeout is only obscure outside of the conservative circles. In May 2019, issue of Chronicles then-editor Chilton Williams explained the merger between the Charlemagne Institute and the Rockford Institute. There were a lot of practical reasons. First was Devin Foley, one of the founders of the Intellectual Takeout, the CEO of the merged organization. Foley has a track record as a fundraiser. He was the Center for American Experiments Director of Development in nearly a decade. He secured more than $800,000 for Intellectual Takeout in its second year. Foley would keep up increasingly firm ground financially. they go through the other reasons here on that as well. In 2019, Crockett, then vice president and general counsel of the Center for the American Experience, said things to a New York Times reporter that were widely denounced as racist. The reporter was working on a story about xenophobia and anti-Muslim political organization in St. Cloud, and Crockett provided the headline, quote, "These people aren't coming from Norway." Despite its connections to Chronicles, the center avoided the naked racism on display in Charlemagne and used rhetoric more palatable to mainstream Minnesota conservatives. The center suspended Crockett vocally and publicly, and she never returned to work there. A few months later, though, journalist Heather Goss revealed racist emails between Elliot and several of his former mentees. In the email, Elliot proposed a slate of code words using Hawaiians and Alaskans in place of slurs for Jewish people and black people, respectively. Wow. Charlemagne fired Elliot within 24 hours and hired Crockett a couple weeks later. Her title at Charlemagne was the same that had been at the center, vice president and general counsel. These positions did not seem to have existed before Crockett was hired, though, and did not seem to have been filled when she left 10 months later. She wrote a handful of articles for Chronicles and Intellectual Takeout, but are all dated after she left the organization. For whatever her limited role and short tenure at the Charlemagne Institute, Crockett's time there showed a loyalty to a distinct political movement of which Charlemagne Institute is a small but forceful player. The movement is explicitly nativist and anti-democratic and at least willing to entertain white supremacism and anti-Semitism, if not fully embrace them. Yay. And somehow, this person was able to get the nomination in the Republican Party. When Republicans look at me and say, you label all of us. Yeah, I do. Yeah, I do. 20 years ago, a person like this would have never even been allowed in your freaking GOP convention. Now, you got people associated with groups like this who are getting nominations in the party. Now, she made her comments. They're not from Norway. And she didn't necessarily make the comments, some of the other comments mentioned in this article, which I will post a little bit later on. But the best the Republican Party can do at this point, the best, is say that you're extremely tolerant of extremist, anti-democratic, anti-minority, anti-Jewish language and behavior. You're tolerant of it. That's the very least we can say. Sad part is, there's a lot of people in the Republican Party that agree with it wholeheartedly. Because this is how this party has changed. And Trump, that was his job, to come on out and say, hey, cockroaches, you no longer have to hide when the kitchen light comes out. And frankly, they don't. Not anymore. 952-946-6205. 952-946-6205. It's a Minnesota reformer for that story. It's the Matt McNeil Show right here on AM 950. AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota, the Matt McNeil Show. Say you work someplace, and once a month, all of a sudden, four or five of the employees just would start saying very loudly some of the most racist, anti-Semitic things you'd ever heard. Would you say nothing? Would you stay there? I wouldn't stay there. I wouldn't stay there, and I'd sure as heck be saying a lot. And so, you know, once again, it doesn't seem like there was anything Kim Crockett wrote at the time she was at that organization, the Charlemagne Group. But at the same time, it seems like that there was a narrative going on behind the scenes at the very least. That's what at least seems like from the article from the Minnesota Reformer. 952-946-6205. I don't know what promoted this guy up in Brooklyn Center. I don't know, but you know, it's sometimes they read things online, not necessarily anything from that group, but they read something online and then they start running with it. And in Brooklyn Center, the man has admitted staging an arson attack by the political left on his property 2 years ago, then using the ruse to cheat his insurance company out of $61,000 and collect thousands more in donations. Dennis Mola, 30, pleaded guilty Tuesday in U.S. District Court in Minneapolis to one count of wire fraud in connection with falsely reporting that someone torched his camper in September and sported a because it sported a Trump 2020 flag, and then his garage door was tagged with graffiti, which once again it was an Antifa symbol, it was an anarchist symbol, a Biden 2020, and then Black Lives Matter. And the first thing, and we went back to the, I went back to that show and listened. First thing we said is okay, anarchist symbol has nothing to do with Joe Biden or Black Lives Matter. And yeah, I don't know why someone would think that those would be there. That was where we started saying something didn't seem right here. Federal sentencing guidelines call for him to go from nearly 3.5 to 4.5 years, but the plea agreement gives the federal judges wide latitude when it comes to sentencing. Well, he's going to go to jail. He's going to go to jail for a long, long time by the looks of it. So, and I'm not exactly sad. 952-946-6205. We are heading on out to, the show will be posted a little bit later on. I got to get up there. Crooners Supper Club coming up here. It's off Highway 65 in Moore Lake. We are going to be up there. We got the movie that we're going to be showing. We also have a panel afterwards. We got Rick Smith is going to be on the panel, and as well, once again, Brett, the maker of the movie Palace is going to be there, right?
Absolutely, yeah. All the more reason to head out there.
And Marge Hoff is going to join us up there as well. So join us at Crooners once again on Highway 65, just north of Moore Lake. I will bring the AirPods. I will bring them the AirPods for them. I hope I find the person that I belong to. Oh, I think I'm going to go get $28 of Taco Bell and see how long I can make it. Devil Radio coming up next here. And then 6 o'clock hour, Native Roots Radio. Till tomorrow. See ya.